Last November, I got together with my friends Todd and Carrie Alexander, and they put on an incredible event. The first annual Grenache Fest was held in Walla Walla, Washington on November 3rd, 2023. It featured 12 Grenache wines from Washington State producers. After the seminar, which was moderated by yours truly, there was a concert featuring Stephen Malkmus from the 90s underground grunge band Pavement, M. Ward, and Mark Pickerel, who is returning this year as our musical director. It was hands down one of the best wine events I've ever attended. And it was such a success that we're doing it again this year. Save the date, November 8th, 2024. If you're a producer wanting to pour your wines, if you want to volunteer, or if you simply want to attend this year's event, go to GrenacheFest.com and sign up on our email list to be the first to know regarding all things about this year's event.
Hey, I'm MJ Taylor, also known as a black wine guy. I went from being a totally obsessed wine newbie to becoming the world's first ever African-American fine and rare wine auctioneer in less than 3 years. In this show, I'll be talking to the mavericks, the philosophers, the players, and the deep thinkers who inhabit the world of wine. They'll share their experiences on how they made it, but more importantly, how they failed and got back up again. So grab a glass and let's get to it. This is the Black Wine Guy Experience.
Hey everybody, what's up? It's your boy MJ. Welcome to the Black Wine Guy Experience. My guest today is the winemaker at Desperada Wines, Valya Frome. Desperada is the chronicle of Valya's twists, turns, and epiphanies as an explorer in a young and wild land. We're going to unpack that later. Valya works with 20 plus of the Central Coast's finest vineyards, and with her Desperada label, she creates inspired, elegant wines free of stylistic constraints and dogma. Wine critic Jeb Dunnick wrote, "The wines of Desperada deliver serious depth and richness while staying pure, classy, and very drinkable." Welcome, Valya.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Oh, this is so cool. So, like, you know, I found Chris during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And Chris works with you and your husband, Russell.
You found him during the pandemic.
Yeah, I found him
like
during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's good.
Everybody was on social media way more.
Yeah.
Drinking them way more.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, and, you know, I had bought some of his wines, and then he sent me some of your wines, and they were amazing. And thanks. And then I've, you know, just coming to Paso, you know, just I was like, I gotta sit down with her. And also I met Russell at Hospice 2 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah, and he was funny as shit. So, and
yeah, just, he's a good dude too. Yeah. Both those boys are characters.
What wines did you bring today?
I brought you a little mix.
Okay.
Now we'll try some things.
Right.
We're going to start off with Sauvignon Blanc because some people say that's what I'm known for. I don't know. It's my favorite white.
Yeah.
I would say for sure. And I don't want to block your camera here.
That's okay.
It's all right. We do about, I don't know, 3,500 cases, give or take. And out of that, half of that is white. And out of that, 90% is Sauv Blanc. So we do about 8 to 9 different Sauv Blancs every year, like single bottlings, every vintage.
Yeah.
So we like to mix it up.
Well, that's why I said I'd never tried any of your Sauv Blancs.
Yeah.
But why the Sauv Blanc? So which one is this?
So this is called Vella.
Okay.
And this is from our estate vineyard up in York Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Shell Mountain. And this is a 22. And it was fermented and aged in a mix of French oak cigars for about 10 months of different ages. Brand new, a little bit once filled, and then some neutral barrels. It's a little bit cold, but it's a really cool area. People don't think of, you think of Paso, you don't think of Sauvignon Blanc. York Mountain's a whole different beast. It was an AVA, actually, predates Paso, right? And it's closer to the coast and super high elevation. It's the highest little vineyard up in that little pocket. So, and you know, Sauv Blanc comes off early. So we grafted over some really crappy Grenache in 2018. And I was like, I'm going to do Sauv Blanc. And this was like, whatever the fuck you want. And I was like, okay. And I love it. It holds its acid up there. And
well, the aromatics are great. Yeah. So, and how many different bottles you say you make of Sauvignon Blanc?
Eight to nine on any given year. Yeah.
And then like
a couple of Chardonnays.
Yeah.
And then we do anywhere between, what would you bet? Yes, I would say 16 to 18 wines a year. So, you know, I got eight or nine reds in there. We do a lot of little bits. Yeah. I like to experiment. I like to have a good time. I don't want to make the same wine all the time. You know, yeah. I have the same husband at home. I have the same child at home. I can't mix those up all the time. So I got to mix up my art, my wine, and have a good time. And, you know, otherwise I think I'd get bored.
What is that show? You could do the spouse swap. What is that show? I can't
That sounds exhausting.
And then like you're a winemaker. Like, why does new mommy have all this wine?
The alcoholic. Yeah, mother. Exactly. Yeah. It's horrifying.
All right. So I like to start at the beginning. So where are you from, Valerie?
I was born in Oregon, but I grew up in Southern California for the most part, and Arizona. So we kind of flip flop back and forth between Arizona and California.
Okay, so born in Oregon. Were you born like in small town Oregon, Portland, Oregon?
Super small town, Klamath Falls.
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I've never been back since I was one. So
okay, so you were just born there.
Literally just born there, and then they moved to California.
Okay.
And then they just kind of floated all around southern states.
And Valia, what that name is? It's I don't. It's a different name.
Yeah. It was my grandmother's name.
Okay.
And cute little Jewish woman.
Okay.
Originally from Canton, Ohio, but our family was from like Austria-Hungary, that part okay. of Europe at the time.
Yeah.
And apparently it's Hebrew, but I've never verified that. I've never really. I think she was full of shit. She's like, that little rabbi told me means valuable, and I was like, you made that up, and that's okay. I love you. So I was named after her, which in the Jewish tradition you don't do. You don't name after the living.
Okay.
Because that's like a curse. You just don't do that. And my parents wanted to, and she was really excited, and the rest of the family thought it was a really bad thing. And she said, just watch me. If I don't die within 24 hours, we're going to be okay. Yeah. And she was my only grandparent. So she was like my mentor. She was amazing. Yeah.
And so did she live in Southern California?
She did.
Okay. So... Yeah. You leave Oregon at one. Where do your parents first land in Southern California?
You know, my grandmother at the time was down in like the Long Beach area.
Okay.
So they went down there, and then from there she moved up to Mission Hills down in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And I think they kind of followed her around, but they went to Idaho for a little bit. They went to Arizona. Like they traveled like they were in the military. They were.
So you went to a
roaming.
Bunch of different schools.
I went. God, probably 10 different schools.
Do you have any siblings?
I have an older brother, 4 years older.
Okay.
Yeah.
How'd you guys get along?
Not well. Not well.
No?
No, unfortunately.
I mean, because he's 4 years older. I think he'd be super protective.
You know, he was.
Because you'd be a freshman, he'd be a senior, so you'd stay away from my sister type
thing. Yeah, he did. He protected me when we were little for sure. We just fought like cats and dogs at home. But like he was a good brother for sure. Yeah. He wasn't like he was just, you know, we fought.
Yeah. What did your parents do? Like, they seem like nomads. Were they in the CIA? Were they?
Yeah, I wish. Wouldn't that be cool if they were like spies or something? Like, that'd be so rad. No. My mom managed apartment complexes.
Okay.
And my dad did all the maintenance for them.
Right.
And
so I get it.
Yeah.
Because you don't pay rent. You don't have to pay rent.
Exactly.
So you're ready to move.
Yep.
And you have experience. Yep. Experienced apartment manager. Yep. And you're a couple.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah. And so you just do travel around, do the things.
Yeah.
And then they ended up retiring I was in probably fourth grade, maybe third, fourth grade, and they decided to move to a small town in the mountains of Arizona. And that was it. And they've been there ever since. And that's where I went to middle school and high school. And there's not even a stoplight there.
What's the town?
It's called Snowflake.
Never heard. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, is it northern Arizona? Southern?
Yeah, it's like 2 hours east of Flagstaff, almost to the New Mexico border. So it's that no one's ever heard of it. It's like 9,000 people. Yeah, it was a real.
So what was it like
from La Jolla? I went from La Jolla to that in like fourth grade, and I was like, "Oh, you assholes! It's cruel."
Oh.
I know. My brother was in eighth grade, and we were just like, "What are you doing?"
Oh.
So, but you know, it was all right. It was an experience, and that's where we did our thing. And then I've left when I was 17.
Okay, so when we were warming up. Asked about athletes, and you said Nadia Comaneci. Did you do any athletics when you were younger?
I didn't really. We moved so much. I never really got into sports because we never stayed anywhere. My grandmother would put me in tennis camp when I was a kid. I really liked tennis.
Okay.
Bougie white kid sport.
Yeah.
But, and she lived like near a little country club, you know, and she was older. So like that was, it was perfect. I really liked that, but in general, no, I didn't really do a lot of sports.
Yeah. So you graduate 17 years old.
Graduate.
Where'd you go?
I floated around. Yeah.
Did you go to school at all?
I moved back to San Diego, okay. Which I always kind of felt like was home in all those moves.
Yep.
So I moved back there. I did some community college. I worked in restaurants and kind of got the wine bug and then decided to not go the traditional like college route and started the WZ program.
Oh, okay. So.
And got a job selling wine as a brokerage and just kind of did a bunch of things and then circumvented and moved to Canada for a number of years.
All right, so we got to unpack all this wine journey, because then people are like, I'm going to be all vague. So that's all cool. Like, you know, I had Don Burns on. He fucking got on a boat and sailed around.
I almost got hijacked by pirates. He's a fucking pirate. I love that guy.
So, like, let's get to the story. So I get it. La Jolla is dope. San Diego's dope.
Beautiful.
I moved back down there.
Yeah.
And it's always easy to get a job in a restaurant or something. Yeah. It's always hiring.
Yeah.
Okay. What, and you said it's kind of where you caught the wine bug. What kind of, let me back up. Parents, any wine on the table growing up at home?
Never.
Any alcohol? Didn't drink?
Nothing. Didn't eat well either. Sad food. Sad. I mean, I love them. They fed me. Don't get me wrong. This was not like a gastronomic household. There was no appreciation. That's where my grandmother came in. Like, she took me to my first opera. She took me to, like, you know, we'd go to stay at a hotel and we'd get room service. And we'd go to cool restaurants and, like, all that kind of culture. Like, that just wasn't my parents, you know? Like, and they are great parents. They're loving, sweet, lovely people. But culture wasn't their, you know, just not their bag.
It's not most people's bag.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean, let's be honest, you know.
I mean, it is in my world now. I think that is being normal, but it's not. It wasn't
in the '70s. No, people weren't.
Yeah,
I mean, most people's parents. Well, I grew up. Most people's parents didn't drink wine. I didn't know anybody's parents drank wine.
Yeah,
or make anything.
Did
but
you
like
grew up
meatloaf.
In
yeah. Okay. So I'd make a meatloaf and just your basic fare.
Yeah.
You know, maybe roasted mashed potatoes.
Yeah, some peas.
Yeah, peas and carrots out of a can.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. That was it. Yeah.
So I think that's great. Like your grand, you said even before, your grandmother was like your mentor, exposed you to things. I mean, that's so
it's
eye opening, right? Like, you can have them bring food to your room. Like, it's transformative.
What a treat. Oh my God. And they serve you. I think everyone should have that in their life, right? Like, every child should have somebody that treats them a little, like, shows them something different, you know? And it doesn't, and I still, those are, like, still treats, you know? Like,
totally.
If Russell goes away on business, I staycation with my kid, I'll take her to a, you know, find a little hotel, and I'll order room service sometimes, and, you know, not very often, but she's like, wow, like, this is so cool. Like, think of those things as a kid that you think are really special, you know? And that's... Yeah, she did those things.
They say everything leaves marks on children, right? So so that's a good mark, though.
Yeah.
All right. So, but you moved back. You knew nobody there? You just like...
You know, my grandmother was there.
Oh, she was there. She was,
she was still there. She was still alive at that time.
All right.
So I moved back there and...
Did you stay with her for a little while till you get your money in your own place?
I didn't. I went straight into my own place. I got a cute little like... one bedroom kind of like studio place close to downtown, and but yeah, I'd been in and out of there my whole life, so I always felt like I felt comfortable there, and yeah, I got a job serving because I'd been doing that since I was, 17. I worked at it's called Rainwaters.
Okay.
It's like old school steakhouse. I don't even know if it's still there, but it was downtown, and that was like an institution,
right?
And then from there, I went and when Donovan's first opened in La Jolla, which is another steakhouse. So I worked in a lot of steakhouses. I don't eat a lot of red meat, but in a lot of steakhouses I've worked at.
Well, that was kind of like the scene back then.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? It was
It
wasn't...
late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, it wasn't like...
Yeah, it was Ruth Chris, and it was, you know, more like Chicago, and Mastro's, and...
Yeah, that's... Okay. And as a server... I assume those places had wine lists, so you started,
And a really cool som who was super into wine.
Okay.
And would take the time to every single weekend, we'd start off with like wine education. And it was just really cool. It was a whole different world. than I had ever experienced.
So, do you remember? That's so funny. Do you remember like the point where you were like, like during the session, like this is kind of cool. Like this is more than just, you know, oh, let me have some wine.
Yeah. There was, he opened a Cornas the night before. Cornas.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not French, let's be real.
I'm going to say it all wrong.
Yeah. But he had opened it, and he talked about like how like tight it was, and opened it the day before, and then poured it for us in this decanter, and it was just like, what do you mean he opened it yesterday? Like, I don't, knowing nothing about wine, but then, I don't know, I just, I got caught up in this, in the history and the diversity, mm-hmm. and then the fact that it was like my grandmother painted, okay. and like I can't even draw stick figures if I'm lucky. I can barely, I'm a good writer actually, but like, you know, that was never my skill. And I would watch her do these beautiful, like she worked with oils and she was super talented. And I always wanted to be artistic growing up and just didn't ever feel like that was my niche. And this, I kind of realized in that moment, like this is an art,
okay.
you know, wine and food, like these are art forms and it doesn't have to be drawing or painting or any of that stuff. So that was kind of inspiring. I was like, wow, this is a thing I'm really into that I can do someday. At that point, I didn't think about making the wine. It was just about learning everything I could and, you know.
So you said, you know, I have this gypsy vibe, this gypsy spirit about you.
Like, I mean, I was born with it, right?
Yeah.
It's genetic, my parents. Yeah, I don't know what they were doing.
So what was like, the next job or next city?
So yeah, I did the wine stuff. I did the restaurant stuff. I did that for a bit. And then, I was trying to be more of an adult. So I got a job at a wine brokerage, which sounded really fancy, but essentially it's just sales.
Sure. Well,
which is great.
Well, but so I got people who, obviously people that, well, not obviously, but not everybody is in California because we don't even have wine brokerages in New York and New Jersey. We have distributors.
Yes.
Explain to them, that's something I learned when I moved to California, what a wine broker is.
Yeah, well, and there's a couple different styles, right? Like, you can have a broker that works for, like, a distributor, someone's, like, going to take your wine and go out and sell it.
Mm-hmm.
What we actually did was essentially telephone sales, which sounds crazy, but we would have clients all over the country, and we would essentially handpick wines for them and sell them wine via the telephone and ship it to their homes all over the country, which is bonkers in retrospect, but it's actually a really interesting model. And so they would source wines from all over Italy, France, like all over the world, mostly Germany. Well, not mostly, but a lot of really great German wines. So I got to deal with all these really amazing international wines, which is where I hadn't really had a lot of experience, and then sell those. And then I ended up not really loving the sales side as much,
yeah.
But was really good at the other stuff. So I ended up managing the offices, an office.
Let's back up. So this is, okay, so so that's that wine, there's a wine broker. So wine broker is just like, it's like a
salesperson.
Salesperson.
But, yeah, that's
but right. Like, so, and this was based out of where?
It's out of San Diego.
And
two of my, some friends that I worked with there at that time ended up leaving that company and starting their own company, and they're still down there and they're fucking killing it. They have a tasting room open now. Like, they're super legit and bring in really amazing wines. So, if anyone's looking,
what wine like
broker.
What
and
like,
how
what,
cool like to have a wine broker? Like, I have a very good.
Yeah.
Source wine
what,
for
like
me.
What year is this?
This is like
time frame.
302
Okay. 0302 Yeah, no, because I worked in auctions, and auctions sometimes would work at wine brokers, and there was a guy out of Texas, Jim Lou, and he was called the wine broker. Back in the day. But yeah, so
it's a trippy business. Wine's a funny business.
It is, you know, and like and doing shit like brokering deals between private collectors and mm-hmm. people, and like arranging to have it picked up by FFE mm-hmm. and delivered and
transported correctly.
Yeah, but like so like this always fascinating me going back, like, cuz it's 02, 03, like Did you see the job on Craigslist? Was there an ad in the newspaper? Because it's not like people were crazy online
question.
Back then, you know what I mean?
It was in the newspaper.
Yeah.
It was in the newspaper.
Yeah.
We had newspapers back
exactly.
then. And we read them. We circled things.
Right.
And read, it was a newspaper.
Put it on the refrigerator.
Yeah.
Call them tomorrow.
Yeah, they
hate
were
my job.
Looking for brokers. And me and my girlfriend, my roommate, we went and interviewed. And we were just like, wow, this is fun. It was like crazy and zany. And because you have to be. If you're trying to sell wine, especially over the phone, like, you better bring it.
Right.
And so every day was about bringing it. Like, it was practical jokes every day in the office. We wore wigs and hula hoops and like you just had to keep it fun but sound serious. But like you gotta be, it's sales, so get your energy up, like, right? Bring it. And so it taught me a lot, and also lots of PTSD from picking up the telephone for many years. But was
do you remember interesting. Can you say what so and so wine brokers value?
It was, yeah, no, it was, they don't even exist anymore, but yeah, it would be Gerhardt Wines. Yeah. And then, but you'd have this whole pitch, right?
Well, you have a script.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So this, okay, so just so you guys, for me, this is something I encountered in California. They're all over, but California, I think, is one of the biggest places. Well, that's where I worked, but also they have these, but boiler rooms, like just phone sales in California. Yeah,
just call centers,
like, yeah. 500 people.
But it's like sweatshops.
I worked at one in Santa Barbara. It had to do with wine, but just a script. And it literally have your objections are written in your script if somebody says something.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, and we had a whole monitoring system.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys had this, but this was really cool. And to this day, I love it. I wish I had one. But like as a manager, you could pick up the phone. And like,
well,
phones had silencers on, right, so yeah. I could hear your phone call, and then I could coach you, and so you would learn to follow my words, one or two words behind.
Yep.
And yeah, it was like there's an art form to it.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
That's why people's like, well, how do old people or how do anybody get scammed? Because these are written. Yes. These are, first of all, I mean, wine's a little different. I mean, you still have to sell it, but at least a lot of these, like you said, there's an art to it. It's your tonality.
Yes.
It's waiting. It's a pause. It's like. There'll be in a script. There's one script is like, just wait. You know, or people go like, well, my credit card's in my wallet, and my purse is in the kitchen. Okay, go grab it. I'll wait. And I mean, like.
Yeah, how you tell people to do, like when you tell people to do something versus asking, like there's a you know, it's a whole thing.
So. But so you did that for a
while. I did that for a while.
But you were like, you're obviously, if you could manage an office, you're. Organized.
I like the business side of it more than I like the sales side of it. And I love the wine. I love the wine more than any of it. I really, the sales side of it, like being, having, you know, like quotas and sales go, like that didn't stress me out.
Well, it is tough with wine because, you know, it depends on who you are. Like there's people back east who like New Jersey is a three-tier system. It's a crazy state.
Yeah.
There's so many people who don't. I don't even think they like wine. It's just a job.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
They go in. They check their floor stacks. They don't. You know, accounts get a lot of allocated wine, not because even the account knows about the wine. It's just because they sold so much of the floor stack and shit. You know what I mean?
It's just business.
I get the business, but like for me, I fell in love with it. So it's like, you know, like it was. It's kind of just, I hate when people dissociate. With it.
It made me sad. I was like, but I love this.
Right.
I don't want to just sell it to, and what if you don't like it?
Right.
And they're like, no, it doesn't matter. I'm like, but it does. It actually does matter if you don't like it. It makes me sad. I care about them. These are my clients.
Yeah. You did that.
So I did that, and then I was trying to do the WSET program at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yep. And then I think it was the last time I had a stress dream where I had my teeth were falling out of my head.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. This is not a good quality of life, you know? And I felt like too, living in San Diego at the time and just, you know, it was the early 2000s and people have their bougie purses and, you know, I'm trying to like make money to pay for my car payment. And I just, everything started to fall. I couldn't figure out why I was doing it all.
Mm.
So I said, fuck it. And I sold everything I had and I bought a really cool travel pack. I backpacked around Central America and Mexico for a few months.
What was that like?
Really great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now tell tales from the adventures on the backpacking route with Varia. Yeah.
Did
you go through Tijuana? What was your entry into Mexico? And you were talking about
on a bus. Yep, absolutely. San Diego bus all the way straight to Mazatlan.
Wow.
Which is a haul.
Yeah.
And it was colder than I thought it would be. Which again, like, never had done this before, and I was like, "Well, duh! Look at the weather." But we didn't have like iPhones, right? It wasn't like we weren't checking the weather like that. It's like you had to go on,
which was a really cool thing,
and look at stuff. And you're like, I got there, and I was like, "Well, this is cold." So I took another bus down even further south until I got warm weather, and then hung out kind of on the coast. And then there's a backpacking route, which, you know, I realized really quickly there's a whole There are people just like you doing it from all different countries, and all of these really cool young and old people all kind of follow a route. And like, you meet someone, they're like, oh, you got to go check out, there's these great waterfalls over here, and you do this, and then you stop in this town, there's this great little coffee shop right there or whatever, and like, oh my god, there's an orchid forest over here, and you got to go check that out. And so you just, you hear stuff along the way, and plus you have your Lonely Planet guide. Everyone has their little Lonely Planet Bibles, and you got your travel pack and your travel pillow and your, you know, and you meet all these amazing people along the way. And that was life-changing for sure.
How far down did you go? You said you're Central America. So how far down did you go?
Guatemala was the furthest.
Okay.
Yeah, on that trip.
Now, you're a single woman traveling alone.
I was with my girlfriend, that was like my roommate, like my bestie at the time. We started off together. We ended up separating and we reconvened about a month later.
Okay.
Because we met other people on the way.
Yeah, no, backpacking is an interesting thing.
Because people
are like, yeah, I met this woman who was a backpacker. Like, literally, they're like, yeah, no, well, she's like, we can go backpacking, but like, you know, I might meet another guy in a bar and might want to go off with him for a month. Like,
for real.
And
that's normal.
Yeah, that's normal.
Right, yeah. It is. And I love the people that I'm, like, people like that. Like, there was this one guy, and, like, he'd spend 8 to 9 months of his year on the road. Like, and he was a really, John Gradeville from Iowa. He was amazing. He's since passed. But he was, like, a 6'4" white dude.
Mm-hmm.
And in, like, you know, if you're in, like, indigenous parts of Mexico,
they
had to put him up on the top of the bus, often with the luggage, is where he would mostly travel, because he was so big, he wouldn't fit in the bus with all the little people.
God.
And but he would spend all his time traveling. And after about 3 months, which was kind of our plan anyways, yeah. But I was ready to, I'm a little bit more grounded.
Yeah.
But that was good to know, like, hey, I don't, this is not for me as a long-term plan,
right.
But I loved it. And and I do still love to travel. And I think since then, my longest trip has been like a month, which is plenty of time.
I mean, that's very uncommon in this country. People will take a month and travel. So,
yeah. But I like being I like to having a home.
Yeah.
I like having a home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
So.
That is so hilarious. So, so then you have your adventure, right? You have your Jack Kerouac moment or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
And then you come back and you go back to San Diego?
I come back and I go to Ohio. I met back up with my friend.
Okay.
That's where she was from.
Okay.
And I went to Ohio, and this was winter, and I was like, ugh.
Oh, that was fun.
Yeah.
From Guatemala to Ohio.
Yeah, that's really fun. And then from there, I had a one-way ticket to Greece.
Okay.
I bought myself a one-way ticket to Greece before I went totally broke, thinking that I was gonna move to Europe and I was gonna get into wine in Europe and I was gonna live there and get a job. I was gonna start in Greece because I wanted to go to Greece, and I was gonna move to Italy. That made sense, which makes zero sense, but at the time I was like, no, I totally got this. They're just gonna let me in the country. And I'm gonna get a job, and yeah, no. So, but I had that ticket, and it was a couple months down the road, so I had time to kill, and I didn't have a lot of money. And a lot of the people that I had met traveling that were really cool were Canadians.
Okay.
And I was pretty embarrassed to admit, you know, growing up in the States, this is our biggest neighbor, this is our biggest trading partner. There's so much, you know, amazingness and closeness, and yet we know nothing. They teach us nothing in school about Canada. And
they wouldn't even teach us the metric system. They tried, and they abandoned it.
Which is heartbreaking.
It is.
I still work in
because you're working in liters of barrels.
Yes.
I mean, like
they say fucking asymmetric way. There's a reason for that. Like, it makes sense. It's tens. Like, God.
I know. That's like...
Anyways,
we can barely do math as it, but it is. But like,
it's true.
So much easier to divide by 10 than by 12.
It really is. Yeah. Yeah. So I was very inspired by how much common sense they had. So I took a bus. I made my way to Buffalo, and then I took a Greyhound
to
Niagara Falls and called a buddy that I had met that lived in Toronto. And I said, hey, can I crash on your couch? And Kim picked me up, and then I met up with some other friends that lived about an hour outside of Toronto, and I ended up spending most of the summer there and stayed there for about 5 or 6 months, just mooching, essentially. But camping and just hanging out with people and appreciating the land in a way that I didn't ever have the time to do here. you know, or really grow up doing, you know, like we went camping as a kid, but this was kind of a different thing. It's like, hey, we're going to go grab this canoe and then we're going to portage over here to this island and then we're going to camp there for 4 days. And I was like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that sounds great. I'm in. and we did, and it was great. And then after about 6 months there, I was like, I have zero money and I have zero plan. So I need to get my shit together. And I really wanted to get back into the WSIT program. So I moved back to the States. I moved back in with my parents.
Did you not go to Greece? Did you never punch that ticket?
The ticket expired and they wouldn't give me anything about.
The ticket expired. Okay.
So to this day. Yeah, that's, yeah, had a year to use it, and I didn't use it in time from the year of purchase, not the year of travel. So that was my first big travel lesson as an adult. But you know, fate has a funny way of, or whatever, I don't know if it's fate or choices. But
so this warmed up nicely, come down.
Yeah.
100% Sauvignon Blanc, anything else in here?
Mm-hmm. Clone 317.
317 on Amazon. 10 native yeast, surly, neutral, French oak. Your wines... The artwork on them is outstanding. Talk about just
yeah,
a little bit about that.
And as I said, I am not an artist in the drawing sense. Right. So having somebody that creates really like good packaging is really important. And I think like you've seen Chris's labels, you've yep. seen my husband Russell's labels. Mm-hmm. Like we, to me, I think we all understood early on, like you can make great wine, right. but if you don't catch somebody's eye and they pick it up and buy it, it doesn't matter.
Thanks, Uncle Manfred.
Yep. He certainly helped with that, too. Yeah,
yeah,
a lot.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I can tell, he was the first one to really... I mean, okay. Yeah,
in the States.
Mouton, yeah, Chateau Mouton, but they commissioned like ours. But that was like, we own so much money, we can
get
the rights and license your picture for a label. But like, actually going out and working with someone and then bringing the vision, like, this is what
yeah,
my
wine... Yeah, and doing all the cuts himself. Like, yeah, no, it was... yeah, I think that was... So smart. Yeah. So, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. So we have a creative team that works for both of us,
okay.
both of our brands. And Jillian and Cameron heads it up, and Elena. And these people are incredibly talented. And, you know, especially because I'm doing 17 wines a year, and Russ is doing like 14, 15, 16 wines a year. That's 30-something wines. And every single label changes every single time for both brands. So,
it's, cool. Yeah.
So we share those guys. They're great.
Right. What do you have? You have a Chardonnay.
I got a Chardonnay. Yep. So this is 21. This is from Bien Nacido. You may have heard of it.
I might have heard of that vineyard.
And this is iBlock. And this is own. Let's see. Own rooted, planted in like 72 ish. So these are, you know, yeah.
52 year old vines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is like a.
So it's old vine Chardonnay.
Old vine Chardonnay comes in with. Perfect chemistry, like just don't screw it up, don't, you know, mm-hmm. just be nice to it. This sees a lot of new French oak from Bel Air, which is one of my favorites for Chardonnay. Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't, I mean, it's not obtrusive.
I mean, and that's why I like Bel Air. It's pretty, it's really elegant.
Yeah.
For Chard, it integrates really quickly and it doesn't kind of sit heavy on top. It's really pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it depends on the year. Some years we dial it back a little bit. Some years we go all 100%. Just kind of depends on the vintage. And
oh, that's good.
Yeah, 21. That's yummy. 21 was pretty stellar.
Vinicito, classic. Okay. So you moved back from Canada, eh? And
well, so I came back yep. and I got a job for 6 months and okay. I worked like 70, 80 hours a week with the goal of saving money to move back to Canada.
What was it? What was the job?
So.
See,
how long is your podcast?
We got time. Okay, I'm long format. Okay, I told you we had 2 hours. I'm blocking out.
My parents, when they moved to that small podunk town with my brother and I,
okay, yes,
they didn't have work. They were both kind of retired and disabled retired, so they were just sitting around doing nothing. And so they decided to do foster care for Native Apache Indian babies,
wow.
Native American Indian babies, sorry, whatever, verbology, having verbs,
I understand, yeah, no.
having words. There's an Apache reservation okay. really close to where my parents live.
Okay.
And so a huge Native American population all over
yeah.
the state.
Yeah.
But there was one very close to them, and they were, you know, some places on the reservation don't have, some homes don't even have good electricity or running water.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have babies born that have real special needs, and needs like lung machines, or they're, you know, in preemies that have like, you know, or they're autistic or they're whatever, they don't have the resources. And so my parents started taking in foster babies. And so at one point we had 8 babies, all under like 3 or 4 years old. And then, and this is like junior high and high school era where you're just like, and it was like a medical ward in there and it was crazy. But at the same time, they just like, they'd call them and be like, got another baby. And like, this baby needs help. Like, you know, like when he was born, he was 1.5 pounds. Like he wasn't supposed to survive. And so they started taking in all these kids and, they ended up adopting 6 of them, which is a huge deal to, they had to like petition the tribal council to
get permission. Yeah, that's got to be more of a deal because you know what's crazy? This is my life. I am going to go out of frame. I literally, this is a book I read on the plane over here.
Oh, wow.
One sitting.
Wow.
And
really good then.
Really good.
Wow.
Because I met the author. The author actually is a like senior vice president for Gallo. Oh.
Random.
Yeah, you know, I met her at an event.
Yeah.
And we were talking. She said, oh, I wrote a book and, you know, I'm fostering kids. And so, this is someone who, I mean, she had means.
Yeah.
But it talks about how difficult it is. And we're not even, if you're in foster care, there's shit going on in the home. If you're in foster care on a res, it's twice as difficult because there's 2 sets of laws. I went to law school. My favorite class in law school, no bear on my life, whatever, American Indian law. I think it's like one of the 2 A's I got at law school. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so there's a tribal council and then you're dealing with, but then also there's the
laws of the white man.
White man, DCF.
It's complicated.
But when I read that book, I can't even imagine like, and kids, traumatic. A kid could be 5 years old and has had so much trauma that they're violent. And then to adopt. I mean, but then they come to your home. You fall in love with them. Mm-hmm. So you have 6 brothers. So now you have 6.
So I have 6 younger siblings. Yeah, 3 have passed.
Oh man.
But I mean, at an older age, like in their late teens and 20s, like you know that. The deck was so highly stacked.
Well, that's
the fact that they made it that long is amazing. Right. And you know what I mean? Mm. And these kids are amazing, not because like not despite their disabilities, but because of them.
Right.
And like so, the 3 that you know, like my 2 sisters and my brother that are still with us, like the 2 girls, they still live with my parents. You know, and they've gone into group homes and lived independently before, but like they really like being at home with my parents. Yeah. And so I think that as long as that's a possibility, it makes them all very happy, and they're awesome.
So
these are my girls. These are my kids. Yeah. You know? And so I moved home because at that time they weren't adopted; they were fostering, and so they had so many hours of like respite care from the tribe and from the state. And so I went in and I got certified to go in and be the in-home health care provider for them, so that I could live at home. But I'd get up at 5 and I would work in my parents' home, but with all my siblings. So it was really cool. Like I get to make money and spend time with my family, knowing that I'm going away again for a while, a long way away. So that was a really cool, special, but weird thing. But yeah. So
yeah.
I did that for 6 months.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And banked a bunch of money and then moved back to, bought my grandma's old Buick and drove that I've driven to Ontario so many times in so many beat up fucking cars. It was a baby blue Buick. That thing was such a champ. But I drove that back to Ontario in April of 2005.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I love this. It's like this is like, because for me, all this stuff is what in the end informs what's in the bottle.
Right.
You know?
Right.
100%. I mean, so like when I thought I was joking, oh, well, we're, you know, twist turns of his as an explorer in a young and wild land. I'm like, yeah, we're going to unpack that. Yeah,
But you're right. Like, that is what goes into, and I think that's such an important thing, too, especially when you're selling wine, if you're in your tasting room or whether somebody else is selling your wine, or whether you're just talking about it. Your heart and soul and passion goes into these. And if it doesn't, you're doing it wrong. So it's, I think it's really, really important, you know. Yeah, yeah.
So, it sounds like you were intent on becoming a Canadian.
I really tried. Oh, I did. I did. I mean, like, I applied and everything.
Healthcare. You're like,
I was like, oh my God, socialism? Yes. Makes so much sense. And it was also, there was a political climate here in the States at that time that I was happy to be departed.
You know what's
from.
So funny? That was the Bush era, right?
Yeah.
Remember when we thought that was bad?
Yes.
We were like, this is the worst.
I'm moving out of the country. Yeah. I was like, take my passport. I never want to. And now I'm just like, oh, wow.
Shit. I'm like,
Yeah. It seems like Shirley Temple days exactly. Right there. I was just like, so relaxing. God, I wish I had appreciated it more.
I know.
But I mean, I couldn't wait to, I was so dead set on, on getting the fuck out.
And it's hard. And what's actually interesting, and I also get why. I know where it's going to go, but like immigration policies, like we do need a better immigration policy in this country, because you can't just go to other countries and get jobs and shit. Like you can't do that in Canada. You know, New Zealand, you cannot stay in New Zealand if you don't have a job past that. You have, it's not like you have
they
to.
They do not want, you're they not going to come here and mooch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And,
but also to make it so hard that people can't come work.
Well, like, is that another? Yeah.
And it's not a perfect country for sure, but like just seeing some of the systems and processes there for like immigration and for offshore labor, the way they treat that, I'm like, that's fucking brilliant.
Yeah,
how can we not have better
adoption
of some of these systems in place?
I have theories that it's all fucking, it's all just fucking politics, or as we call it, politricks.
Right.
Say we want to do something, and we don't do anything on any fucking thing.
Yeah.
On any fucking thing.
It's really hard not to get apathetic.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
No. Which is a bummer.
It is.
Because, yeah.
But
goes back to your earlier questions, right? Like, in theory,
right?
Invoking change and like making a difference and like helping people, like all of that it's there.
Right.
It's so hard to do.
Right.
It's so hard to execute.
Right.
Yeah.
Then there's what's called inertia.
Yeah.
So you were able to get some type of job to see
so
while
I,
you were there.
So I drove my Buick. I had a boyfriend that was Canadian. So I met a guy there. Yep. And
every good wine story is about a guy.
There's a dude.
Or a girl,
there's a dude or a chick. There's somebody. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know that I would have gone back. Right. Without there having been some sort of love interest. This is a story, of course. So there has to be a love interest. We did drive through Indiana, which was really fun because you can fill up your car full of fireworks, which is super fun, which you can't do in California.
Like,
there's got huge warehouses of fireworks. And I was like, you know how much I can fit in the back of a Buick? Oh my God. So we loaded that bitch up with like $60, filled the whole trunk, and just drove across the border. Because you go through like a small border crossing, right? Like Erie or something, where like nobody gives a shit. And those fireworks lasted us years. They were great. Love fireworks.
Okay, so yeah, I was like, clearly you...
Fireworks are fun. So... my ex-boyfriend, who is a lovely human being, he got a job he was in the horticulture business.
Okay.
So he got a job on a 200-acre nursery stock farm owned by a bunch of Mennonites in outside of like Waterloo, Ontario. And so he had this old Mennonite farmhouse like built in the 1800s, and it was a free place to live. And we're like... Perfect. So drive my Buick, got my fireworks, and go to the farmhouse, like live on this land. It's so beautiful. And it was a great place to live. So then I got into the WSET program. Mm-hmm. I applied for residency, tried to become, not a citizen, but tried to get residence so I could live there. And in the meantime, I got a job at the farmer's market working for a butcher. I worked for a smoothie lady. I did some under the table behavioral therapy for autistic children because I had plenty of work with that. And so I did all these little odd jobs. Opened a credit card. That was a bad idea. Like just tried to make a living there. And it was, and it was tough without being able to work legally for sure.
Shit, yeah.
And I tried to hit up the wine industry there, and I'd go to interviews and they would hire me, and then American, like, we're not going to sponsor you. I was like, yeah, why would you? I don't blame you. That's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did he offer to marry you? I mean, that's always...
No.
No?
Yeah, he was kind of a good dude.
Yeah.
A little odd dude, but also, like, everything, 3.5 years I was there. We were there and had a great, great, great time. I made a lot of... And then I, like... It was those formative years, right? Like 27, 28, 29, 30,
yeah.
Where like I mean, I still have friendships and still go back there once a year, and friends come to visit here. Like, it's, I meet a lot of lifelong, really good people. But after 3.5 years, our relationship was starting to falter a little bit, and it was really getting hard to see my family, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, because getting back in, it was
back,
becoming,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, with and the last time going back in, it was a nightmare, and I was like, I can't keep doing this. And then they denied my residency application.
Okay.
Which I had dumped, you know, 10 grand trying to get, you know, a lawyer, all the legal yep. shit. And I was like, that's a sign. It's time. It's time for me to go. So I bought a travel trailer that my dad told me about.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 1977 Royals International Diplomat with shag carpeting and two twin beds.
Shag
carpeting. You remember that?
Yes.
And some guy in Arizona owned it, so we hired some dude and put it on his truck, and he drove it to California. And I had, while I was there through my wine program, I had met up with a distributor that lived outside of Toronto, and he had been working for many years there and wanted to, we met in the wine program, and he was like, you know, I really want to diversify my portfolio. I've always been bringing in Australian wines, and the market there was a little bit, I'd say, kind of behind our market. So there was no Italian wines and no French wines in there. So I started working for him under the table, bringing in wines, and got to go to France and got to go to Italy and source wines for that. And then bring them in and try to sell them to the monopoly, because it's a whole different system up in Canada.
You know what? This is a perfect time to take a quick break, because I want to hear about the monopoly, because I've heard about the monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear about the monopoly. I want to hear about your trips to Europe. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Valia.
Hey, I don't know if I told you guys this earlier, but last year, Grenache Fest sold out within 72 hours. So if you want to be there on November 8th, 2024, make sure that you go over to GrenacheFest.com and sign up for the email list, so you will be the first to know when tickets go on sale. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. This was a one-of-a-kind wine and music festival like no other I've ever seen before. Don't miss out. Go to GrenacheFest.com for more information.
Okay, we're back. So, Adventures with Valia, like...
It's getting
good,
huh?
It is, I know, yeah. Trailer, transport to California. Okay, but you said you met a guy who was importing wines, Australia heavy, and this must have been in the era, like, the down here is Grateful Palate, but all the Australian wine collection, all the mm-hmm. Parker, Fruit Bombs, big... Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, okay, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so you said you got to travel to... Where was your first trip to Europe for wine?
My first trip was to Italy.
Okay. And where are you, where, when you're like,
where
this
I was, a, I was like, destined, full circle, yeah, right. Full circle. Right. Yeah. So he sent me to Italy. There was a wine show up in, I don't know, somewhere in the Veneto. I forget now in this moment, but, you know, it was a wine show with, like, where people go and sell their wine, trying to find distributors.
Is that
in
Italy?
No. It was super tiny. No, it was up like northeastern. Yeah, I don't even know where Italy is. I've never been.
It's in Verona, which is north.
Oh, and then, but it wasn't
and
Italy.
Alta Adige is like about an hour. You know, so it's like that, you know,
yeah.
It's a little bit.
Yeah,
Verona's
east
a,
of there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
east
okay.
of Alta Adige.
Totally cool.
It was fun. Went and tasted a bunch of wines, talked to a couple people, and said, we would love to import you and bring you into Canada.
Okay.
And then kind of learned that whole process of, you know, importing, dealing with the monopoly.
What is the monopoly? Because... If you're not from Canada, or you're probably not going to know what the monopoly is.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know about a three-tier system-ish, because
yeah,
New Jersey
yeah,
and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, but there, every province acts very independently, just like our states do as far as alcohol goes. But it's all, most of them, not all of them, are monopoly-driven. So there is a government entity that controls all of the wine that is brought in, how it is sold, who it is sold to, etc. So as a distributor, though, you can bring wine in consignment. And you can bring it in, so you can bring it in yourself and you can sell that direct to a restaurant. But if you want it to be into a store, you have to deal with LCBO, which, again, every province is different. But in Ontario, it's the Liquor Control Board of Ontario, which is a very huge purchaser worldwide. Like,
right.
They're in the top three, like, single biggest purchasers of booze in the world. It's bonkers.
Yeah, and isn't a monopoly somewhere else, like, in Europe, too? Because when I was in Verona... Mm-hmm. I was on a panel talking, and the monopoly. I'm going to like, oh, there's one in Britain too. Like, how much wine
yes.
they buy? Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yes.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's it's
well, like their purchasing powers. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and because it's monopoly and also because it's a socialized country, like the taxes are nuts.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to export and sell wine there because it's so expensive. Wow. Like, why would you do that? You know, like when you're there, you don't see a lot of you don't see these wines, or like yeah. most of us.
Yeah.
You wouldn't ever sell wine there because it'd be triple the price. Like, right. why would you do right. that? No one's going to buy it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a, but it was it was such a huge, interesting learning. Like, wow, it was super fascinating.
Where else did you get to go when you worked with this distributor?
Italy twice, California, which sounds weird, but yeah. he also didn't have a lot of California wine. And I was like, guess what? I'm from California and I got this. So I said, let's take a sales trip to Paso because Napa is not going to be Napa Sonoma from a dollar standpoint is not going to be where we're going to want to, like, again, the, you know, we're talking like 112% markup is the tax going into Ontario alone at that time. I'm sure it's different now, hopefully. But I knew that the Central Coast was a good spot to find okay. wines that were better value and that were better priced and were still really good quality. And at that time, we're still kind of, you know, I mean, I had come here in the 90s and was like, wow, this is like Wild Westy where they're like,
yeah.
great wines, great price. You can kind of do your own thing. And I just thought that was a good spot. So we came down here and started, we found a couple wines to import and then decided to make our own wine and import that. Because that seemed like a good idea.
Here on the Central Coast?
Yeah, here in Paso.
Okay. So let's back up. You also mentioned France. Where'd you go in France?
You know what? I lied. I didn't. I went to France this year for the first time, or okay. this last year for the first time ever. But Russell, we always joke because, like, I've been to Italy like 6 times.
Okay.
And he's never been there, and I've never been to France, but he's been there, and he's like, how can you not go to France? Like, it's like the Mecca for wine people. And yeah. I was like, well, it's okay. never went. So yeah, I just went to France for the first time last year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you decided to make your own wine in Paso.
Yes, we decided as, so it was me and my business partner who owned a distributorship in Ontario,
okay.
and then we had a partner in Alberta, which okay. is not monopoly driven and is actually a, like, just run your own province there.
It's a free market.
It's a free market, which was really nice. So we decided, hey, let's buy some bulk wine, let's put it in a bottle, and let's export it to Alberta and Ontario, and let's, and then we have control over the price, you know, because that's, again, such a huge issue there. You know, to get good wine at a good price. Like, that value is, it's pretty skewed.
What was that wine? What was the bulk wine you did?
It was a cab.
Okay.
Yeah, and we bought it from Castoro, because they have a large bulk program.
Yes, they do.
And
a lot of y'all are drinking wines that you think are special, and they're bulk wines.
Which doesn't make them not special,
no,
but it does make them bulk wine.
I'm not going to go
there. What's in the bottle? That's a whole different thing. You want to talk about that? You want to pull the mask away?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's a fun one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole seedy underbelly of the wine business.
Fuck it. I don't care. It's just, black owned doesn't mean black made.
Also true. They said it.
Sorry, said it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Or that if you have your name on a wine, you're a winemaker.
Right. Or the word vintner
yeah.
doesn't actually mean anything.
Right.
Yeah. This is what you do. You're a winemaker. I'm like, oh, please, no. I would never call myself that. Because I actually do make the wine.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to be real clear about that. Because right. some people just say, oh, yeah, I'm a winemaker. I'm a vintner.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, they don't make wine.
Yeah.
That's why I say.
You say you're a brand owner.
Yeah.
Call it what it is. We're not.
You're a smart business. I was like, those are really smart business people.
Yeah.
I don't know why there's something in my genome that's off just a little bit, because I think I'm reasonably intelligent, but like going back to what you said, I'm so passionate and there's an integrity thing with me with wine. Anyway. Yeah.
It is really hard. I try not to get like on a high horse.
Yeah.
I try not to. It's really hard though. Like there's there's so much bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, like between that stuff and real ownership, real winemaking, the ratings system, like there's so many things that it's really hard not to get and just be like, yeah, no, it's all good.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's all good. It's fine.
All right. So speaking of wine, we got some reds, right?
Yeah, we got reds.
By the way, this fucking Chardonnay is banging.
Thank you.
Your wines are outstanding.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So this is 21. It's a pretty decent vintage for us. Yeah, where's the bottle? I don't want to be in your way.
Oh,
this is Petit Verdot. And this is mostly from our vineyard, Shell Mountain.
Shell Mountain.
And then a little bit from Lunacy, which is west side Paso, but on the north end up Adelaide Way.
Now, in the beginning, in your bio intro, you know, Jeb said your wine's serious depth and richness while staying pure, classy, and very drinkable. This is a big girl right here. Mm-hmm. It's a big girl mm-hmm. wine.
You know, I think it's deceiving. Like, I do a lot of Sauv Blanc and I do a lot of white. And I think people think the reds are going to be really light too. And they're not.
No, your reds are.
But I'm also really unapologetic about it. We live in a place where we get big, rich, round reds. Yeah. And they're not like, we do a Nebbiolo too. And it is true to form. But it still has, what I want is, I want structure and I want depth. And it doesn't always have to be, it doesn't have to be a fruit bomb because of that. Like, this is.
Right, this is not a fruit bomb. No. It's 16% out, but it's not a fruit bomb.
It's not.
It's super dry. It's balanced.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
But there's a lot of, structure.
I get more sweetness in some of those more popular, inexpensive brands. Mm-hmm. Or brands that are around this price range that are very, very popular.
Yes.
The most popular.
Yes. Which again,
like it's incredibly. I think you said pure classy. It's very dry. It's very balanced. It's everything's in harmony. It's not out of whack.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have no problem with alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't care how high it is. Right. If it's balanced, right. I'm cool with that.
That's
if
what
it's
I've
not,
always
then
said.
It doesn't
listen,
matter.
I'm like, listen, it's not that I don't think wine can be. You know, low alcohol and tastes good because look what they've done with Riesling all the years. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But when you're picking first week in August and then throwing stems in there, this is my personal thing.
Bring it, go. Let's do it.
I don't, and you're coming in at 11% out. I don't understand it. Yeah. Like it's not.
Well, there was the thing. I mean, I'm sure you remember it. This was, I don't know, a decade or maybe even longer ago. I don't know. Time's weird, but like the whole like In Pursuit of Balance thing and like. Picking early and like appealing to the Somme market,
right?
And that really offended me on a number of levels. And I don't want to offend light wines or Somme style wines or natural wines or low alc wines. Those are all fine. But if you're picking for the sake of having low alc,
that's the problem. Yeah,
you missed the flavor,
right.
Which
that's
my husband likes to say. If you make it taste good, they're going to buy it, right. And he's absolutely right.
Well, that's what, and when you
it should feel good in your mouth, and it should taste good, and regardless of when you pick it, and
right.
So to pick it, so that's the opposite, like that whole, you know, idea.
Right,
was
that
like,
is like when we're talking about, so that's being on a soapbox,
yeah,
and you're trying to make a point that you and your 12 friends want to have made,
right?
And again, you're free, but. You know, like your husband said, I remember Phil Couture said, if you're talking about being a natural winemaker, first of all, wouldn't you be in sync with the lunar cycle? So Phil believes nothing should get picked until after fall solstice.
Right.
Right? Because that's actually the natural order of things.
Sure.
Which
I love, and I keep the biodynamic calendar on my wall, and all those things. But, and sometimes years are
sometimes
weird,
you have to pull it in.
But then to say that you are pursuing balance when you are picking early for the sake of picking early, that's the opposite
that's
of what
completely
you
pursuing balance,
just
right.
said.
Right.
Like, taste the grape.
Right.
Does it taste
good? Like that, and that's so many people like they like I know when to pick, you know, and just Phil doesn't like people come and he's like. It's not ready. People want to pick, and he's like, it's not ready yet. And people are like, fuck, I don't want my wine to get ready. He's like, it's not ready. Like, taste the grapes.
Does it taste good?
If the grape tastes stimmy
and
like,
green,
what,
and you got, like, your seeds, you're like,
it's just, who go, perfect. This wine is going to be balanced.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think a lot of people who listen, drink those wines on this podcast anyway. Because
I've turned them off.
So I'm preaching
like,
to the choir.
Right.
Yeah, they're like
unfollow.
Although they do, they'll leave a comment on that shit. And then they'll have me blocked so I can't respond to
it. Do you get pissed when you read like...
Oh, sometimes. I don't get a lot, but I'm like, first of all, motherfucker, you don't know me. Someone will be like, oh, I see you like high fruit bomb. I'm like, motherfucker, you don't ever drink wine with me.
Right.
That's
come hang out with me,
yeah, come out
but
with
actually that. Don't because
actually,
I don't
because,
like
you. Know
you.
What? Because, but, you know, no. Two things. But you can't hang with me because the wine you're going to bring really isn't going to fit in with the good shit me and my friends drink.
Damn, that's right.
Fuck, I'm on one today.
This is the first interview. This is the first of four. Yeah. Sorry.
I've only had like a sip
of
wine. This is just,
I know.
Just,
it's all in there.
It's in there.
I know, you got things to say.
Oh my God, so do you. That's why. So you guys do that, your bulk wine and Paso Robles.
Bulk wine, we make this little label, probably with a Microsoft clip art or whatever the fuck it was. It was awful, it was that bad. But we did it and we sold it and we're like, okay, all right, how do we do this in a more sustainable way? How do we do this better? So we came back down and there was a gentleman here, a couple gentlemen actually, a couple people that were like, if you're going to do this thing, there's a way that you do it. And they mentored us in this part of the business.
Yep.
In not just buying bulk, but like, get a fruit contract, grow grapes, talk to a custom crush facility. Here's how this works. Because really, and this is something that by that time I had always wanted to do, but didn't have any, like I'd never done production. Right. And, you know, some people go to, there's two ways to make wine. You either go like we call them the Davis kids. You either go to school for it or you learn by doing. And they're both fine. Yeah. They're both good. If you have a good palate and you know how to taste things and you know how to cook, as also my husband likes to say, he's like, if you can cook, I mean, wine is cooking, right? Yeah. It's flavor. It's building those things together. Right. So if you do those things, I don't care how you get there. You don't have to go to school for it, but you have to. You got to get there.
Yeah.
And so we had some really great mentors that were like, these are the steps that you got to do. And so we decided to pull the trigger and do it. So I moved that trailer down here. I parked it on a vineyard where we decided to contract fruit from. And there was...
You are a wild girl.
It was nuts. It was a nuts time. I brought me and my... I drove my Camry because I had a different car by then because the Buick died. Dropped the transmission outside the lake. Bought myself an old Camry and I drove it back with my crazy dog and a trailer and parked it on this vineyard and lived there for a couple years and bought her fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And she was and still is amazing. And she's actually since sold that vineyard. It's a sustainable biodynamic vineyard on the east side of Paso up in kind of like the, like by Independence Ranch, Hog Canyon area.
Mm-hmm.
But she has sold that vineyard, but she had great fruit out there. And so, yeah, we bought that. And then I made the wine, which just means like I watched all the people do the things that first year and got a job as a cellar rat so I could be around it. And so I could understand what they were doing. And then I was like, fuck the rest of that. Like, this is in the cellar is where I want to be.
Okay.
And that was that.
And so you're living here, you're living in a trailer on a vineyard,
mm-hmm.
making the wine for them.
Yeah. And did that for a couple years. That first vintage, I just kind of oversaw, made sure, and then also learned to do all the business side of stuff, which is the really unsexy part of
exactly, yeah.
Because you know, it's like, hey, here's QuickBooks, here's cost of goods, here's inventory, here's all that shit, and you know, go get a business license, go get an alcohol license, go get all these things. So I was the person on the ground with my two partners in Canada, and I made a business. And that was really interesting and taught me everything that I needed to know to then go do my own business. Yeah. Which was really cool.
So you're bopping around town?
I bopped around Paso.
And you see this big, tall drink of a man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, I called him the Neanderthal for the first, like, 6 months. Because he was just like... Because he looked crazy. He was always looking crazy. He got crazy hair. And he was always... And he's funny, right? And he's just funny, a funny dude. And so, yeah, I'd see him walking around the Custom Crush facility. Because at that time, he had a brand with another guy here in town, McPrice Myers. They together had their own brands.
Who's coming in behind you?
Oh, lovely.
Mac is coming in next.
What's up, Mac? So him and Mac had Barrel 27.
That's two big dudes, man.
Two big dudes.
That, like, you know, that, what's that
and
podcast?
And big personalities.
Yeah, two bears in a cave. That could be a wine podcast.
Those boys. They are big boys.
Yeah, okay.
So they had Barrel 27 that they started together when they were 27. And then they each had their own brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so their own brand, and then they had a little winery over on the east side of Paso. So they had their own brands there, but Barrel 27, like, they would also use the custom crush facility that was there to help make that wine. So yeah, so he'd be bopping around there or whatever. And I actually needed some bulk wine to, you know, I needed Pinot. Cause I was like, my partner's like, hey, we need something besides just Cab, you know? So I was like, all right, Pinot around here. And a buddy of ours, Anthony Bazzano, was like, oh, call Russell. Him and Mac always got things. So I called this guy and he's like, yeah, meet me at the winery on Sunday and we'll taste some barrels. And so I met him there and he was like, kind of hot, kind of weird. And we tasted the barrels and then he's like, do you want to go have a beer? And I was like, yeah, sure. I don't drink beer, but I was like, well, cocktail, whatever. And he invited me to a deer hunt that weekend, which he doesn't hunt anything except for ladies at the time. But I was like, yeah, sure, I'll go on a deer hunt. And so that weekend I went out and went to his buddy's house out at Stockdale and they hunted a deer and they had a little barbecue. And then I invited him back to my trailer. And then we just did that for a few months. We just had random sex. We didn't really talk much. We didn't kiss on the mouth. We didn't really have conversations. It was very casual. And it was going into harvest, too. So that was, like, September. So then it was harvest season. Yeah. It was just, like, whatever. We'd occasionally hook up.
Yeah.
And also, like I said, Neanderthal, big, crazy guy. And then after a few months, after harvest ended, and it was a few months, it was, like, I think it was right around the holidays. And he invited me to go camping in Big Sur. And we went camping. And I realized he's actually a really smart guy. Mm-hmm. He's not a Neanderthal. And he's quite funny. And he's a really good dude. Yeah, so we both decided to get rid of all the ancillary people in our life and do it. Yeah, right. So we've been together ever since.
How long was that?
That was 09.
All right, and so he had that there, Max, and he has Herman Story Wines.
He has Herman Story Wines, yeah. And so in 11, I think, he split from Barrel 27.
Okay.
And needed a home. And we would always... You get off on that Paso Robles Street exit and to go to the co-op facility or whatever. And he would always pass this building and it's in this like automotive section and there was a for lease sign there forever. And he needed a place to have Herman Story. And so he stopped there one day and we converted it, built it out into a winery. And that was, we finished it the week of Hospice Durone in 2011.
Wow.
And it was nuts.
And then when did you launch Desperado?
So by that time I had had a few barrels. So all of his wines and my wines at that point were over at the co-op facility.
Okay.
At the Custom Crush. And so we, once we finished that building out in May, we moved. I mean, I had like 6 barrels at the time. He's like, do you want to move your barrels? I was like, yeah, can I? I'll work in your tasting room. And so we moved his barrels in, we moved my few barrels in, but I hadn't bottled anything yet. And then, yeah, we moved in there and we ran that place with just me, him, and, his cellar guy that had come from Barrel 27, Nerys, who's still with us and we call him Hefe cause
he's the boss.
Cause he's the boss. Yeah. Yeah. He's a good dude.
So. Now, when you had these barrels, did you already have Desperado in mind?
No.
How did you come and, you know, tell people what it means to you?
Yeah. So we move in there, it's time to bottle. I have 4 barrels of red at that point and 4 barrels of white,
okay.
6 barrels, 8 barrels. And so I bottle it with no label or anything because, it's time to bottle.
It had to be bottled.
Got to be bottled, yeah. But you know, the labeling. So, and then I hit up, there's, you know, when you look at label and design and stuff, companies start to all look like each other, mm-hmm. right? Like you can look at a label and be like, oh, that's Kraftwerk. Like they use this much foil. Like they all start to look like each other. And I really loved Russell's labels and not just him, but everyone that was in, at that time, there was a company called Proof Wine Collective and they did, Folkway wines. They did Saint-Lige. They did Field Recordings. They did Herman Story. And they were also doing a bunch of stuff for like Trader Joe's and everything at the time, but they had these, I mean, just badass fucking labels. And Russell's buddy worked, he was one of the owners of it. His two friends owned it. And so I hit them up and they're like, unfortunately, we're not taking any new clients. We just can't. And, so I kind of like floundered with Shiners for a while and, hand wrote my name on them and would just like sell them out of his tasting room. Until one day his buddy that owned Proof called and said, what are you doing? This is really sad, essentially. And I was like, I know, but I don't want to hold out. I'm holding out for something good. I don't want to just go,
right.
You know.
Spend. I mean, because, I mean, you can make, just slap a label on it and
could.
Put it in the market.
A white label with black writing. I could have, spent $5,000 and had somebody do it, but that just didn't seem right. So they said, well, you know what? We said we might take on one more, and if so, we wanted to have a female-owned brand. So we got you. And then I walked into that office and it was like going to a psychiatrist meeting. It was like, I was there for 3 hours, like laying on the couch, like, why are you doing this? What are you doing? What does this mean to you? And they went through, they dove really, really deep into, what are you doing? And that, and then I came back 2 weeks later and they're like, these are your three options. And Desperado was one of them. And it clicked. You know, there's a feminine mm-hmm. and there's a masculine to it, mm-hmm. which is, I think very, you know, it all embodies me in how I see it. And the wines are like that too, you know, and it's the feminine version of a Desperado, which mm-hmm. again, these are like, this is not even a real Spanish word. It's a made up word, but right. someone that's an outlier, someone that marches to their own beat, someone mm-hmm. that just does their own thing.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of, especially coming into the Central Coast and especially Paso, where it was all very Rhone based and very Rhone heavy. Mm-hmm. And while there's always been plenty of Cab here, at that time, especially, was not like the forefront of really great wines outside of probably Justin Isosceles and, you know, that kind of thing. Everything else was like, you know, for many years in and then move into the Rhone game. Yeah. And so I wanted to, I love Laventure. Like that was my inspiration. It's mm-hmm. like, you can make really badass, beautiful Bordeaux style wines here. And,
And so, first vintage with your labels, an actual brand.
Mm-hmm. 09 for red, 10 for white.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, so, and you just had two wines. And then the next vintage, how many wines did you produce?
Three.
Okay. So, mm-hmm. two whites and one red?
Two reds, one white. Yeah, okay. I kept just Sauv Blanc for many, many years.
Okay.
And then in 12, we added in Presqu'île Vineyards. So, in the beginning it was McGinley. So through time, and you know, and again, this is a huge credit to Russell, just like learning the contract game mm-hmm. and buying fruit and how that works and what a pain in the ass when you say, can I have like half a ton of fruit? And it's like, you know, people didn't tell you to fuck off because you were a woman. It's because you're a pain in the ass.
Right.
Like buying a half a ton of fruit is incredibly inconvenient.
Right.
And so just kind of learning the ins and outs of that and just, you know, luckily being able to get, you know, that second year I got Sangiovese from White Hawk, which I still to this day get. I wouldn't have gotten that without Russell's contact there at that time. So a lot of it was just luck, you know, a lot of people helping me out, you know, like Steve Glossner at the time was a good buddy of mine. And, you know, he would help me out with, you know, you want to go talk to this guy, go talk to that farmer. Like people were really helpful and a lot of legs up, which is why we, you know, have that philosophy with the people that work with us. You know, we've got 8 brands that have started within our two companies and that's really intentional. You know, we got a lot of help from people. Yeah, yeah. And so pay that forward.
Yeah, you got St. K.
Ultima Thule,
I've had those before.
Lost Blues. Yep. And then Lumina, which is Janie Wilhelms. Mm-hmm. And then Haba, which she's moved into her own facility.
Oh, wow.
She started there. Niñera is a new brand that's coming out of Herman's Story. And then my assistant winemaker, Emily, just made her first wine this year for herself. So that'll be coming in the future also. So.
Why is that important to you to like, I don't want to say people, but to the mentorship, maybe with your grandmother? I don't know. Why is it important for you to see people grow?
Well, we're going to die, right?
My brain's
going to end. Like, I'm going somewhere. Like, why not leave? Like, the real legacy is helping people, you know? And also, you keep people happy, you know? You help them. You genuinely care about them and their well-being and, you know, that they stay with you. They stay, like, that's, you form bonds that are pretty timeless, and I think that's really, really important. And, you know, it's hard. Like, we've had people, you know, Primitive Gary, you know, he started his label with us as well. And he's, you know, he's still one of my kids. Like, these are still people that mean a lot, you know, even if they go on and do other things. Like, you don't have to stay with us. But I think that helping people is really huge, and in any industry, right? Like, it's just good human being right there.
Speaking of helping people, so like your labels can be provocative, suggestive, if you will.
Sometimes there's a lot of naked ladies
like,
out there.
This
is called the Sexy Legs t-shirt. We did a little bit of editing to clean it up, but you get the gist.
And this project you're mentioning, thank you for this gift, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some proceeds go to your local women's shelter.
Yeah, and we try to do that at our release parties too, as we try to, you know, whether it's through an auction or whether it's through the proceeds of these t-shirts, like if we can, help the, you know, the homeless and women's shelter in the area too, like Echo and Rise, like there's a lot of great organizations that, you know, why not give back? Must is a huge one. That's a wine-based one, but that's great for like Boys and Girls Club. Like, you know, it's good to be, we're not just making wine, right? This is a community of people and taking care of one another. And that goes from like, you know, the vineyard farm workers all the way up to, you know, to everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you are, you guys have heard her story. She's clearly a maverick. I want to say I remember you being involved in some Tin City movie. You produced a movie or something about Tin City?
Yeah, Tin City documentary. Was done by Dina Mandy and her group. And it's on Amazon now if anyone wants to go check it out. It was her first feature film and she absolutely slayed it. It's really, really good. It's funny, we were just talking with some show people, some Hollywood people about this the other day, and they're like, you know, we watched it. You're in there a lot. You actually have a lot of play on it. But if you look it up, you're not in any of the credits. And I was like, yeah, it's fine. I don't want to like sound like it's a sexist thing. Maybe, I don't know. It's, you know, I don't get on the high horse about being a woman very often. But I thought that was funny too. But it's a good movie. It shows our little community within a community. You know, okay. And it's a poignant time, you know, like it's, there's a lot of young, small winemakers, and this is a cyclical thing, right? That we don't have money to go out and buy a big vineyard. And well, now we own vineyards, but you know, that's, we've worked really hard for those, but yeah. You know, we didn't start off with a bunch of money right. And go, you know, build a winery and buy a vineyard. So to be able to have a place to go do that, you know, Mike English, our landlord, he had a vision, you know, and he helped a lot of us because none of us would be there without him. So that's pretty cool.
So just for people who might not, who've never...
Sorry, that was rambly. No, but you know what I mean?
My whole thing is rambly. Okay. Okay. Who named, what in the, you know, the name Tin City, where's it come from?
Bunch of tin buildings. Yeah, so we make wine in a little community called Tin City. It's at the kind of south end of Paso Robles, north end of Templeton, not far from Firestone Brewery.
Okay.
And, Barrel House was actually, the Barrel House Brewery was the first one to kind of go in there. And I think that's when Mike kind of saw the vision, was like, hey, we can build this whole community here. And then slowly the wineries started coming in. And now there's a distillery, there's a brewery, there's a cider house. There's probably 20 wineries in there, give or take. I don't know. Right. There's an olive oil shop. There's a Michelin star restaurant, which is nuts. There's a beautiful pasta shop and deli and restaurant. So... yeah, it's kind of grown up into this little community. There's a world-class train exhibition coming. It's going to be opening pretty soon. It's really exciting, a little parklet. I know we need more parking, but aside from that, it's a really cool little neighborhood. But yeah, a bunch of tin buildings, which, what do you need to make wine? You need drains and a forklift, right? So
I love it. You need drains and a forklift. So this last wine sampling.
This is an homage to some Right Bank Bordeaux. This is Cab Franc based.
Okay.
50 Cab Franc with Petit Verdot and Cab. Also all from our vineyard. Also 21. Months aging. New, neutral. Blah, blah, blah.
Tasty. Tasty, tasty. So this is delicious. How many wines are you currently on your current release? Are you about to have a release? When was your last release?
Release went out last week, actually.
Okay.
And then those we've got a release party coming on March 10th.
You've heard her story. You should come in. I'm sure it's going to be a party.
It's going to be we do back to back. So my husband does his release party on the 9th. And that's like Zoo to You. There's like Mechanical Bulls. There's fucking bands. There's like sumo wrestling. There's whatever. It's ice cream trucks and tacos. And it's like, woo! And it's, yeah, it's party. And then the next day is mine. And I do a brunch.
Ah,
I do a very...
you said that when we were talking before. Yeah. Probably
like a brunch. I like a brunch. Yeah, we'd have cocktails.
Do you ever make any bubbles?
Funny you ask. Yes. So actually,
because when I think brunch, I think bubbles.
Totally. So yeah. Well, actually, I did a little aperitivo last year, so we're doing a cocktail out of that.
Okay.
And we have a local chef, Rachel Ponce. She's really badass, and it's quite classy. We've got we do it right. It's 11 to 2. It's a good time. But one of our employees that has been with us, he's one of the OGs. You know, between like. Yeah, I mean, before Chris, there was Gio and Cameron and Hefe. And Cameron owns Ultima Thule. He actually just opened a tasting room in Tin City as well. And he has worked for both Russell and myself since he was out of college. And him and I both have a passion for sparkling. And so we started a sparkling brand in 19. called Scarab. And but there's a that's a whole different system. So we're actually just doing our second. We just did our second release of like 20 cases of 2020 Blanc de Blanc. So really tiny amount still at this point. It'll be a few more years before it's phased up. But yeah, they're really good. All method Champenois, Pinot and Chard, and yeah, pretty legit.
What's it cost a bottle?
The current release is 85.
It's like, you know, like. That's a fair price. It's probably underpriced.
It is. Well, the next one will be more, but it's like, I mean, you know, it's 20 cases.
I had Michael Cruz on, and he was talking about Ultramarine. He was just fucking, just like fucking around, and then he went on like Wine Berserkers, and people were flipping. Like, I think when he released, it was like $40 a bottle, 45, and people were fucking selling for 90.
Yeah, well, there's no way. Like, there is so much more than $40 in that bottle just in time.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
of course,
it's,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, these wines are, we're aging them 3 years on Chirage. Right, like, right. I mean, it's just, it's bonkers how much it costs. And I think it takes a few years to, you know, till you get kind of into like a homeostasis.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right now we're just hemorrhaging cash. Yeah. But it tastes really good. It's really good. Fun.
And I mean, it's part of it. It's meant to shove a wall.
I'm going to drink because I drink so much champagne. Yesterday I was having like it's like year end financial shit, whatever. And I was just like, and Russell could hear it in my voice, and he showed up and he's got like a bottle of like Beecart, like extra brewed. He's like, I'm just saying that. And I was like, yeah, thank you. Yeah. So it's all good.
That's so freaking cool.
Yeah.
So on your current release, you have like, probably like a dozen wines.
There are 6 wines in the shipment, and then there are 4 add-ons, so 10.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lots of wines.
All right, so we're going to play a little game as we come to the end of our time together. It's called Slap.
Oh, gosh.
Lick.
Okay.
Fondle. Give me 3 grapes.
Okay.
Who you slapping? Who you licking? Who are you going to fondle?
Okay.
And I can't put Sauvignon Blanc in here because...
Is the slap like an angry slap? Or is
it's
it
up
like,
to you.
Okay.
It's your slap.
Okay.
Good question, though.
Okay.
Good question.
Just want to check.
Yeah.
Because it could be a loving...
And that, well, it could be...
Anything.
It could be a slap. Oh, my God. Okay. So we're going to do, we'll do Sangiovese.
Okay.
Actually, I'm going to give you grapes, you know, Sangiovese, Zinfandel, Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm. I make Sangio.
I know, but right. You know.
Slap, lick, or fondle. Wow. I'm going to slap Pinot because it's a love-hate relationship.
Yeah, and I was like, that's a slap.
It is. But it's good and bad, you know? Like, some of my favorite wines I've ever had have been Pinots. I just can't afford those ones.
Well, that's the problem.
And then the other ones that I can't afford, I don't want to drink. Yeah, yeah. So it's a love-hate.
Got it.
Yeah, and you know, Lick would be Zin. You know, it can be a really, really beautiful, interesting, well-made wine when it's well-made.
I concur.
Yeah, and then it's not its fault that it got bastardized and just thrown to the curb. And then fondle, Sangio, all day long. So, so beautiful. So, just so perfect.
Mm. Awesome. Yeah. I have one last question. Not like I really have questions, but these are just like 2 questions. Slap, lick, fondle, and this question. Oh, I'm going to 2 more for you. What are you most excited about in the future?
As pertains to Desperado Land?
As pertains to Valia.
What am I excited about in the future? We planted a new vineyard a few years ago, and this is going to be our first year of getting fruit off of it. That's really exciting because it's a really special, like the energy up in York Mountain is really, it's really unique. There's something really cool up there. So it's been beautiful watching that property develop and it was all raw land that had never been planted. And so that was a really cool, like, we bought Shell Mountain, that was an existing vineyard. But this little parcel, I don't know, it's just got, it's got good juju. So that's been a really cool thing to come online.
That's super exciting. Yeah. Super exciting. And we talked about when you were working as a server down in San Diego and the Somme and the Coronas, but what's the bottle, like, what's a really memorable bottle in your wine journey, like, that kind of informed what you're doing, just kind of made you?
Madeira.
Ah.
Hands down, always. I mean, the wine's already gone to hell. It can't ever go bad, right? Like, it has been completely, it's been cooked, it's been, I mean, everything, it's...
That you're not supposed to do to wine.
It's been done, and so, but it's still gorgeous.
Yeah.
And you can open that bottle, and you can come back to it in a year, and it's still what it is. And it's a really, that was pretty mind-blowing. Just kind of, being able to drink those through time. And I've got quite a few of them in my cellar, and I will pop them out when I'm inspired to do so. But yeah, those are really cool.
Love it. Oh my God. Dahlia, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is awesome. So much fun. Yeah. Tell people where they can find you and how they can be a part of what you're doing.
Desperado.com. Check out the website. You can order the wines. You can try them. You can call me and call the winery. We'll tell you what we'll think you like and try a bottle. Try it. Put it in your mouth. Put it in your mouth. Put in your mouth. If you like it, cool.
And for all the listeners out there, don't forget to check out the show notes. What more can you say? Put it in your mouth. Check out the show notes. I'll put links to her website, her social media. I'll list the wines we drank.
Thank you.
I might drop that book we talked about fostering.
Please do. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
So much more. So until next time, cheers to the Mavericks. Check. Philosophers. Check. Deep thinkers, check. And wine drinkers, your boy MJ saying peace.
Cheers. Cheers. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you learned something and you had some fun while you were here. Please subscribe to the podcast and give us a 5-star review on whatever platform you're listening to. And if you want to be an insider and get special content, make sure you go over to blackwineguy.com and get on our email list.